Beyond the headlines, this is World Insight.
From the Great Hall of the People in Beijing, I'm Tian Wei, and welcome to Creativeness and Opportunities, a World Insight special on China's 2024 ongoing political season. The 2024 government work report in China doubles down on the central government's support for Hong Kong. Hong Kong is known for being an interconnector between the mainland and the world on business and finance. Today, it is serving one extra role as a bridge for cultures and arts with an impressive project, the West Kowloon Cultural District. Henry Tang Ing-Nian is a member of the Standing Committee of the CPPCC. He is one of those who planted the seeds of the West Kowloon Cultural District and now work around the clock to present it in front of the world. I interviewed him during the ongoing two sessions. West Kowloon Cultural District, I know you are working around the clock trying to figure out how to make it sustainable financially. Have you figured out a way?
Any cultural projects as such has to be financially sustainable. In most places around the world, it is always supported by government or a very rich organization, company in the back. So first of all, it is necessary. And secondly, our original plan is that government will give us one lump sum, an endowment, and that we will be able to build all the facilities. And that was in 2008. And all the assumptions were based on well before the Asia financial crisis. So therefore, they are very unrealistic. Of course, government then did a midterm revision, but that was before any of the cultural facilities were opened. So now we have opened three facilities, four actually, and also we have operated them for several years. We welcome millions and millions of visitors. They are very, very much welcome and embraced by Hong Kong as well as the world. But at the same time, we realize those assumptions were wrong also. So now we have a much more realistic forecast, and we have presented it to the board of directors at West K and also to government, because three government officials sit on our board, so they are completely au fait of what's happening.
There are media reports, Henry, about the ways that you have figured out or you proposed. Some suggest, would there be bonds issued for the funding of the West Kowloon Cultural District, or should there be tapping into the use of land in the area to make it a small area commercial and use that money to support the cultural cause?
First of all, categorically, we cannot issue a bond, because a bond, we have to demonstrate to the investors that we are able to repay the bond. We are not able to repay the bond without government approval of our revised plan. Right. By the same token, we can go to the banks and borrow a loan and take out a loan to cover the short-term cash flow challenge. But again, we have to demonstrate to the banks that we are able to repay the loan. All the assumptions are premised upon government's approval of our revised plan on better use of our assets. Mm-hmm. The only asset West Kowloon has is, of course, our team. The team is, I think, one of the best teams in the world. Mm-hmm. Other most important asset is our land. So I have thought about how to make better use of the land so that it meets the current demand of the market in Hong Kong in order to make the West K Cultural District sustainable for the next decades.
Mm-hmm. When you are trying to put these different institutions into operation, when you are trying to bring the best exhibitions from around the world to the museums, when you even try to bring some of the biggest names of the world, but maybe they are being culturally viewed differently, how did you manage to let them all shine?
When we curate the exhibitions, especially in the two museums, the contemporary and classical, we are very careful and judicious to curate collections that will appeal to more people, and that it's not something that they are able to see easily elsewhere. Mm-hmm. For example, at M+, it's our contemporary museum that's been open for nearly 3 years, 2.5 years. Mm-hmm. We welcome more than 5 million visitors.
Oh my God.
And we also put on one major international exhibition by Yayoi Kusama, mm-hmm. the very famous Japanese artist.
Yes.
And this exhibition, curated by Hong Kong, and we have sent it over to Guggenheim Museum in Bilbao for exhibition for several months, and it was very much welcomed by the European visitors. And now the next stop is we are then going to Portugal for next exhibition in Porto.
I see.
So it's the first international exhibitions that we curated that we can actually go overseas. This is very much consistent with the Central People's Government mission for us to be the East-West Cultural Exchange, as the 14th five-year plan has asked us to do.
How did you try to figure out ways and solutions to something that you didn't have the answer and Hong Kong earlier did not encounter?
I recently went to see an Iranian exhibition at the Palace Museum here in Beijing.
Yeah.
It was very impressive because their cultural history is as long as, or even longer than China.
Yeah.
So these very rich cultural
civilizations
really need to be shown to the world. And it will help the world understand China.
There has been challenges, of course, in economies around the world, here on the mainland as well. While we are facing this transition, how do you see Hong Kong is making its way, finding its way right now?
We are part of China, so our relationship is intermingled in many, many ways. When China is doing well, we will do very, very well. When China is facing its own challenges, we will face these challenges as well. But we do have one unique strength, which is we have the one country, two system, meaning we are able to do a number of things that the mainland of China is not able to do. For example, we have a capital system rather than a socialist system. We have a freely convertible and transferable currency. And thirdly, we have common law, which is much more predictable to the commercial world. So therefore, we do have our strength, and our challenges is to be able to further leverage on those strengths for the benefit of Hong Kong.
Business community understand it will not happen as the terminologies indicated, but rather there's going to be changes in supply chains and value chains and the ways of doing business. So you are also a celebrated business person yourself in your career. How do you now, with the public service you are doing, looking at all these changes?
My main principle and main rule at West Kowloon is that all our exhibitions, shows as such, will have to be fair, objective, and unbiased. So it is not something that it's done so easily, because first, of course, the most important one is that we have to be lawful. Nobody has a right or has a privilege of breaching the laws of Hong Kong. Secondly, when we curate anything, it has to be curated objectively and fairly and balanced. Mm-hmm. So this is a rule. It's a fairly simple rule, but it's a rule that's very, very important that cannot be breached.
What about people's confidence for Hong Kong?
Hong Kong in the past have faced many challenges many times over. Over the decades, we have thrived under these challenges. Mm-hmm. Every time the going gets tough, the tough gets going. Mm-hmm. And that is the Hong Kong spirit.
I like that. Very nice. So having said that, though, we understand the Article 23 just passed at the National People's Congress. This, of course, is a very important legislation for Hong Kong's future. What is your personal take?
This piece of legislation should be effective, so that we will not leave any loopholes for the subversive elements to try and slip through. So it should be effective, and The fourth and the most important point is that it should be forward-looking. Crime can be committed in more ways than one now. So therefore, we need to be forward-looking so that it will be, in the foreseeable future, still be a good for any attempt to breach national security in Hong Kong. Therefore, national security is necessary for a stable community, for a safe community. With a safe community, we can now all join together as a team to fight for the common prosperity and the livelihoods of Hong Kong.
Both here on the mainland and in Hong Kong, there is a discussion about how to tip that very delicate balance between national security and development and growth. Now, of course, a lot of emphasis is being put on growth, especially when the economy is being challenged. What is your take?
Without security, there is no stability. Without stability, there is no development. So I think there's no doubt in my mind that security is most important. With security, there will be stability. And now that we have stability in Hong Kong, our focus will be on economic development, the prosperity of Hong Kong, and the resources to make the lives of people better.
During this year's National People's Congress and also CPPCC, you see people talk a lot on the new quality productive forces. Tell me more about your understanding and how do you see it also might have an impact on Hong Kong's development?
Well, the hottest topic nowadays is, of course, on artificial intelligence. And artificial intelligence is based on microelectronics.
Yes.
I'm in this industry, so I am very much au fait with what is happening in the industry, and the demand is very, very large. It takes a lot of work and research and also design in order to make these AI chips. Our nation is working very hard to further enhance and to upgrade our technology and our know-how on how to do this. We have made great developments, but we still have a long way to go. So, like President always say, there is no best, there's only better, and we are striving to do that.
Our series is called Creativeness and Opportunities. I'm Tian Wei at the Great Hall of the People. March the 8th marks the International Women's Day. Just like on every day, let's celebrate the contributions made by women around the world. Nancy Yip, an MPC deputy, she and her team at Hong Kong University of Science and Technology have recently developed a blood test for the early detection of Alzheimer's disease and mild cognitive impairment with remarkable accuracy rate of over 96% and 87% respectively. Alzheimer's disease affects over 50 million people around the world. And this breakthrough is believed to be a game changer. And while the central government is working on its transition to a new quality productive forces, what are her thoughts on the strategy? Let's listen to her insights. Professor Ye, congratulations.
Thank you.
Plasmark AD, this test can bring people with accuracy to test Alzheimer's as high as 96%. Wow. Do you know you have saved a lot of lives and a lot of families?
Yes.
So tell me more about it, how it works.
So my research team, we developed this blood test that can provide an early diagnosis of Alzheimer's disease. So for the disease, actually, there are changes in the brain pathology many years before the onset of the clinical symptoms. So we work hard to develop this blood test that requires a very small amount of blood, like one drop of blood.
Yeah.
We'll be able to perform the test and gives a very accurate diagnosis of the condition of the individual. Mm. For example, whether the individual is healthy or has low risk or medium risk or high risk of getting the disease years later, like 5 to 10 years later.
Wow.
So the blood test is highly accurate, 96% for Alzheimer's disease. And very recently, we actually can provide a diagnosis even earlier than Alzheimer's disease. For example, if the individual has mild cognitive impairment, our blood test can also provide the diagnosis, you know, with an accuracy of 87%.
Wow, that's really amazing, because this is a major disease for a human being, I think, for anyone age above 40 years old. I'm sure many people would come up to you and say, Professor, yeah, how can I get tested? Actually, I want to get tested just to prevent.
Yeah. Actually, the test is not available in the clinics in Hong Kong, and we have formed a startup. The university actually encouraged the establishment of startups. So we emphasize and we support innovation entrepreneurship since the establishment of the university. Mm-hmm. So we have a technology transfer center at the university that arranged that, you know, to help us take our research findings from the bench to bedside. So we can take our research findings and take it out of the lab and then implement it and, you know, provide benefit to society.
You know, when the relatives notice that their grandma, grandpa, or their parents not be able to recognize them.
Yes.
That is really a very heartbreaking moment.
Yes. It's really, you know, our passion, right?
Yeah.
You know, how can we contribute to society? How can we leverage our research findings and take it further to translate our findings to, you know, providing, you know, either a diagnosis or some treatment options for the afflicted patients?
Because I'm already getting emotional. I mean, just by talking about it, yeah.
Yeah, because it really, for this type of disease, it's not just affecting the patients, is affecting the families,
the
caretakers, and the loved ones.
Yeah.
And for this disease, it's particularly difficult, heartbreaking, because of the memory loss,
right.
You know, and so, I mean, I've been working in the neuroscience fields for decades, but, you know, I think it was like 8 or 9 years ago, I told myself, I said, you know, I really need to do my best to contribute to this devastating disease, in part because of the prevalence. So globally, there are about 40 million Alzheimer's disease patients, and it's projected to exceed 100 million by 2050. So this is a very, very substantial number. And because of the aging population globally, you know, the number is bound to increase, right?
But you know, Professor, what you said, from bench to bedside,
it's
not easy. It's not like just your work as a researcher.
Yes.
You have to build a whole ecosystem in order to make people have access to it, like common folks. How did that happen?
Yeah, so for this particular blood test, it actually started off as my PhD student's thesis project. So he actually did a very comprehensive study. So our group was the first research group that conducted such a comprehensive study to look at the blood proteins, comparing Alzheimer's disease patients with the healthy control. So when we look at the differences in the expression of these blood proteins, we found that a few hundred of the blood proteins out of, you know, 1,100 blood proteins, they were altered in the blood of the Alzheimer's disease patients. Then we proceeded to, you know, to group them into different clusters,
right.
And then use big data analysis to identify 21 proteins that we call biomarkers. So these are blood biomarkers that will allow us to come up with a method to identify the Alzheimer's disease patients. So,
but to nail down the 21 is already a big process, isn't it?
Yes.
How did you discover them or identify them? Were they by accident, or actually you were doing tests on every one of those? I think that's a tremendous amount of work.
Right. So what we did was we used big data analysis to identify these proteins that are regulated or they are changed during the disease progression. And so that gave us, you know, the clues that these are the proteins that represent the different biological pathways.
Right.
Okay, so leveraging, you know, the identification of these proteins, we validated them based on more than 2,000 individuals in Hong Kong mm-hmm. through collaboration with clinicians in the hospitals.
Mm-hmm. But yeah. that is only narrowing down the 21 proteins.
Yeah, yes.
Not to mention getting the accuracy rate as high as 96.
Yes.
That is another long process,
That's
I
right.
would assume.
Yes. I think based on the research that we did, we identified these proteins that are closely associated with the disease, mm-hmm. right? And through these proteins, we actually can get more insight about the disease mechanisms.
Right.
So that will lead us to, you know, looking into ways to provide treatment. But based on the proteins alone, we can already build this kind of protocol or methodology
yes,
that allow us to develop the blood tests with high accuracy. But how do we take this from a laboratory to bedside? So this would require optimizing the test and also validating the test mm. and then setting up this company that would be in charge of implementing mm. the blood test for the community.
Right.
So that's the other part of the ecosystem. So for the ecosystem to be complete, it requires different components. Mm. First, we need to have funding, right, to allow us to do the research. Mm-hmm. And for this, I really I'm grateful to the funding support from the central government, from the Hong Kong government, and also from the you know, setting up a center in Hong Kong called the Hong Kong Center for Neurodegenerative Diseases. Mm-hmm. So all this funding support and also the platform that was set up over the years, including the State Laboratory of Molecular Neuroscience
right.
to allow us to do the work.
That's the first step, of
yes.
course, and then doing the hard work.
By students,
yes.
right? Talented researchers, including students and staff in mm. the lab.
And
so
patients,
they work as a
team.
Exactly.
Patients.
Exactly. So researchers and clinicians working together, and based on the samples they provide to our research team, we could do the validation, we could develop the tests, right? Mm.
You know, what does it say to you when China makes very clearly that new quality productive forces will be the key for future economic development?
Yes.
Would that help you to connect the dots that you've already been thinking for years as an educator and as a scientist? How can you tap into the advantages that there is such a momentum now?
No, I am truly excited about this this new quality productive forces because it is so visionary. We have to be innovative in our curriculum design. Mm-hmm. You know, how do we train our students? So, for example, we launch Measure Plus X, and X means any emerging technology. It can be AI, it can be anything.
Wow.
So we have launched that, and mm-hmm. the students love it because, you know, they have the opportunity to
think
learn.
And
yeah,
to imagine.
Think. Exactly. So now with ChatGPT, we said, well, we don't just expect students to memorize what they learn in class, but they have to learn how to think.
I really wonder for a female scientist, for a great president of a university, for one who has been trying to connect the dots and bring the best talent to work for humans' benefits.
Yes.
What would be the best gift for you for the day?
I really would like to see more women joining the scientific
community.
Being the first female university president in Hong Kong after more than 100 years, I'm very much honored, and I really hope that there will be more to come. I think we can make so much contributions to the world.
Together.
Together.
Yes.
Yes.
Professor Ye, I wish that hope come true, and happy International Women's Day to you.
Thank you.
Thank
Same
you so
to
much.
You.
That's my interview with Nancy Ip, a scientist who is also an NPC deputy on the sideline of the ongoing political season
in China. And that's all the time we have for today. I'm Tian Wei. On behalf of my team, thanks for being with us. Bye for now.